accession number 11939, Rule 14.
Mr. J. L. Williams, Reel 14. What drills and other things were you learning on your mortar course, Mr. Williams?
Well, it was principally, we learned how to handle the mortars very effectively. And I mean, in the good old army style, you might have been the second lieutenant, but you were treated like a dog and a mortar number. You took your turn in different mortar numbers. And there was no what you could call a squadron or anything. It was all out in the open and out on the plain there. And you did all this firing and so on. And the use of the carrier and that sort of thing, which, as I say, seemed to be a bit overemphasized in subsequent experience. And we would move the carriers up, and then the word action would leap out and rush forward with our mortars and machine under bombs and so on and get in position. And as I say, we didn't fire much live ammunition. I suppose I couldn't afford it in those hard-up days, but we did eventually fire live ammunition and so on. And, as I say, it was a dream time for me. I really enjoyed it.
Were there any specific commands that you had to give to a mortar team?
No, the only thing was you shout action, you know, and you would say things like enemy advancing, 1,100 yards, wait my order to fire, and get them lined up and say, right, let them have it, boys. You're close enough, you know, unless I was on the blower talking to them. But when I was, if I had a couple of mortars in position to kill Germans who were advancing towards us, we were quite close together, because if the Germans were advancing, they were unlikely to be stopping to use their mortars on us, you see, so you were able to blast them. And normally you just say, action, cease firing, when you came out, and that was about it, you know. They were very simple commands.
Was there theoretical lessons going on, you know, learning about bombs and how they were made?
Yes, a certain amount of theory, and a certain amount, people would tell you where they'd been used before and so on, you know. We got very little, we were told very little about the enemy mortars, but we knew they had them, and I suspect these mortars had to be reasonably portable. I mean, you couldn't get men carrying a 25-pounder gun into action. So if you had a 4-inch mortar, you'd have had to have something, wheels or something, to carry it in. So this must have been the ultimate in portability, you see. And we had to, on the principle that there were human beings on the other side, their biggest mortar must have been about the same size as ours, you know. And in actual fact, the German mortar was pretty well about the same. They call them 85 millimetres or something now, but nowadays there were 3-inch mortars. The length across, you know. And as I say, they were just about the simplest sort of. I mean, we didn't put a bit of fire at the bottom of the mortar blow, but we did everything but, you know. The other interesting thing, which perhaps I haven't mentioned, was that there was a centre sort of cartridge which dropped and exploded. And then there was a spring round the vanes, and there were 6 vanes, and there were 6 little packets of explosive. And when you left the little explosive package, they helped to boost the thing, and that was called charge 2. But that meant the thing went right up in the air and took a little bit more time to come down, you know. And also you had charge 2 for the full range, but there were sort of an intermediate range, we'll say about 900 or 1,000 yards, We could use either charge one or charge two.
And did you put the charges on to suit the rest?
No, yes, but what is, you had the six little packets of explosive in what looked like cellophane bags, you know, a little yellow explosive round the center thing. And you always fired on charge two. But if you give the command charge one, the fellow who was putting bomb, he flicked three little packets out on the ground. And as they were clipped in with a... And the place was... If you were firing on charge one, the place was littered with these little explosives. And you couldn't... You couldn't use them after. You couldn't put them back on again. But you normally fire charge two. But and you didn't need flick one every other space. You just knocked three of them off on the ground and the clip held the other three on. And that was sufficient additional explosives. And it didn't travel so far and arrived a little bit sooner. And it didn't have to. But there was a stage where at 1,000 yards, you could either fire charge one or charge two. And if the city wasn't easy, your bomb would go a bit higher up into the air and take a little bit more time to come down and frighten the Germans all the more when it came hissing down, you see. But
were there any accidents on your course?
None, no. No, there were no accidents at all. There were very good instructors, staff sergeants, obviously all regular soldiers. We had to stand to attention and call them staff. Even though we all were second lieutenants at the time, actually. And
where were you billeted? Was it an army camp?
We were billeted in a proper building, a proper army. You know, Netheravon was a proper army camp. I believe later on Netheravon was used for chemical warfare training as well. You know, when you were.
How did you perform at the end of your course? How did you pass out at the end of your course?
How did the testers? Oh, well, we had to take a mortar thing. We had to be number one, number two, and number three in due course and so on. And strangely enough, I never got an individual result. But the instructor said, very good, Mr. Williams, you know. And later on, let's say when I was... with the 14th Battalion, there was my company commander, who was a regular officer, said, do you know, Williams, that you're a very good mortar officer? And I said, well, I didn't actually say, I enjoy it, but I didn't realise it was good. He said, you had a very, very good report, and you're a bloody good soldier. I said, thank you very much, sir. This was when we were in Folkestone, you know. But that was... and then later on, you know, each year an officer has to sign it. Report. If it's an adverse report, you still got to sign it. And this bloke had me in, and I said, don't you realise that you're a good officer, Williams? I said, well, I never look at it that way, sir. I enjoy life. Well, he said, you bloody well aren't. Sign that, please. And, you know, the typical army sort of style, you know.
What happened after your 3 weeks, and where did you go then?
I returned to Bransworth and was immediately posted to the 14th Battalion in Shorncliffe Camp, Moor Barracks in Shorncliffe Camp.
And what was your reception like there? And what date was this, by the way?
I finished in July. This must have been the end of July or the beginning of August, 1941. I'm sorry, I went to Shorncliffe Camp, but I was posted to a company which was outside, near Hythe, you know. And my name, up to that, my name's John Llewellyn Williams. And I've always been known as Lou to all my contemporaries and so on. And I went into I was just posted to the ordinary infantry company when I first went
there. Which company was it?
D Company of the 14th Battalion. And I think there was a Captain Barker was in charge, or Major Barker was in charge. And I went into the mess. He said, oh, you're the new arrival. I said, yes, sir. He said, what's your name? I said, Williams. Oh, Christ, I said, no, man, what's your Christian name? Well, I said, it's John Llewellyn. Would you like to sort something out of that? He said, we'll call you Jack, shall we, old boy? And from that moment, I was Jack. And my wife knew me as Jack and everybody else. So I sort of changed my name.
What was your role with 14th Battalion?
Well, I was with the 14th Battalion. I was with D Company for a while, and I was acting as an ordinary infantry. And we were defending the coast. And we were subject to shell fire from the Germans. And frequent bombing. You remember where we were then? We were about 8 minutes flying time from the nearest German airfield across the channel, you know. And the I was marching along places like Romney Marsh and so on, along the front, doing exercises around places like that, in that beautiful, romantic Kentish country. It was really beautiful. And we were out on night manoeuvres, and we would practice sort of resisting, running down the beach where we could get out. We hadn't get mixed up with the mines and the wire, barbed wire and so on, and various things like that. And then suddenly I was called up to headquarters and took over the mortar platoon.
And how long, what kind of time had you been with D Company?
2 or 3 weeks, that's all. Then I took over the mortar platoon, and it was lovely. Again,
who was commanding the battalion?
Colonel Chips Appleby. Colonel Appleby. And his second in command was Sebag Montefiore, who was a very rich and, dare I say, idle regular officer. I suspect he'd reached the dizzy heights of major because of the war and so on. And, you know, he was really the archaic type, you know. What's that man doing over there, you know? He's filling sandbags, Major. Oh, yes, yes. Incidentally, in the Denmark Review, you're called the Colonel Colonel, and the Major Major, and the Captain Captain. Well, from Captain down, it was Christian name terms, you know. And when the Colonel came to the mess, you never stood up. You just kept sitting down and so on. Very informal, light infantry style, you know. And Colonel Appleby was a very nice bloke. And then there was Major, I forget his name now. He married Sebag Montefiore's daughter. He was a regular officer. And he was a support company commander. I don't know whether one should mention these things on this tape, but I discovered that Major Sebag Montefiore still worked on the principle that there were other ranks and officers. That's all the world consisted of. And he'd rather speak to a man through his sergeant or corporal than actually speak to the man himself. And I discovered that Major Sebag Montefiore was known to the rank and file as Major Shitbank Monday to Friday. Shitbank Monday to Friday. Instead of Sebag Montefiore.
What condition was the battalion in on the coast?
Well, you mean our battalion? Very, very highly trained, and really we were at it all the time, you know. We were just a holding battalion, and of course drafts were liable to go away to other battalions, but in the to overseas when necessary. But in the main, it was the drafting took place in Bransworth, and there was the 14th Battalion and the 16th Battalion and the 17th Battalion down there at that time. Now the 16th Battalion subsequently became a battalion with 46 Div in Tunisia, and the 17th Battalion was ultimately disbanded. I was only talking, my last meeting in the Dunbar Infantry Association of Gateshead, I was talking to a bloke, an old ninth man who'd been with them until it was disbanded and, you know, sent away. What happened to the 14th Battalion, I don't know, because I left it later on, you know. But we also occupied the Sir John Moore Barracks. You know, Sir John Moore was the man who initiated the light infantry. So we were in the Moore Barracks in at Folkestone. And we sometimes had exercises. For example, we had a very heavy exercise called Exercise Harold with the Canadians. We didn't know, but it was just before they did the Dieppe raid. And so it was very realistic, called Exercise Harold because it was vaguely related to William the Conqueror landing and the Battle of Hastings, you know. And we were racing through for 10 days. We never were in bed up against the Canadians in Sussex and that area. And it was obviously, as I say, a sharpening up exercise for the poor Canadians when they went across and got a bit of a hiding at Dieppe, you know.
Were you close to the Canadians?
We had little bit of, except they were along in Sussex somewhere, but we had no associations with them. The only thing we had some... they were a bit excitable. I once managed to stop a real bayonet attack taking place between our blokes and the Canadians, because the Canadians were getting a bit uppity and there were very sort of cracks going off, and both sides had fixed bayonets, and there were certain threats taking place, and I exercised my authority as an officer. But because we'd been out for... we had 10 days of the most glorious weather, and that must have been in... well, the end of July, beginning of August, I suspect, you know, in this exercise, Harold. But I know it was very good. We were all through that beautiful Kentish countryside and into Sussex.
How was the battalion, of course, taking the possibility of invasion? Was there any vision or fear of invasion?
No, there was... we literally were under very... on the daily bombardment. I mean, just let a little bit of sea mist come in.
These were long-range guns, were they?
No, well, there were long-range guns firing. They hit Folkestone House, but they concentrated on Dover. It took 2 minutes 40 seconds for the shell... You saw the flash on the other side, and 2 minutes 40 seconds for the shell to arrive. And the alarm went off, and people went into the shelters in Dover and so on. The gym was hit just behind us, up on the camp, at Shorncliffe Camp, you know. And there were one or two places shelled, but bomb damage was the worst thing, because just let, as I say, a little bit of sea fret or a little bit of mist come down, and Jerry used to dispatch a pair of fighter bombers with a couple of bombs, and they fired and just dropped the bombs in the country and machine gunned the streets and so on. And
did you lose people?
I don't remember any of our men. I remember civilians being killed, but I don't remember any of our men being lost, because we were normally in position. The other thing was, I remember, I'm moving forward a little bit, anyone who brought down or who damaged an enemy aircraft would get a week's leave. And I was thinking about getting married, and I'll tell you about meeting my wife later. But we in the garden, we were right on the edge of the cliff in Folkestone on this occasion. And I had a Bren gun on a tripod in the garden. And I had a few button hours off, and so I was sitting reading just next to the Bren gun. There was a big garden, there were some bushes here. And I suddenly heard the sort of beat of a German fighter coming over. I tossed my book away, and I was running sideways out to get behind the Bren gun. And suddenly there was a private soldier who'd been in the bushes. I mean, he was on the same idea. He wanted a week's holiday. We came charging out, hit each other's shoulder square on, knocked the bloody Bren gun over, and the German plane went overhead. I said, "There goes our holiday soldier." "Oh, Christ," I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "No, it's all right. We both had an equal chance." I said, "What did you want?" He said, "Well, my girl and I think about getting married." I said, "Snap. That's exactly why I'm waiting to shoot." And when we knocked the Bren gun over, and but they got that stage, you know. But they were very frequent, very frequent. I know, if, as I say, another part of my life was in December 41, I was due to go on leave. And, of course, what happened there, I had to go up to Newcastle. There were no restaurant cars, so you got a packet of sandwiches or something from the officer's mess, which was left for you. And I went in there on occasion, and there it was, dry bread and meatloaf. Well, now, you never rollicked servants as such. You always spoke to the president of the messing committee. And I got hold of this book. I said, "Look, what the hell's this? I've got to travel all the way up on a slow train from here up to Newcastle on meatloaf sandwiches, and I pay the same mess fees as the colonel. You wouldn't give the colonel meatloaf sandwiches." "Okay," I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "Well, come on, I want something different." He said, "Oh, hell." He said, "All the servants are off duty now." I said, "Well, that's smashing, isn't it?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, we'll go round to the Naffy." Now, I said, "Neville, you know very well that officers aren't supposed to get stuff from the Naffy." He said, "All right." He said, "I'll take you round the back." He said, "I know the Naffy manager. She's a nice girl. Now, she'll be able to do something for you." And so he took me round the back, and there was this girl here. She was a Naffy manageress. And Neville said to her, "Look, this officer's going up north, and he hasn't, he's got some," he said, "well, I've just had a draft for India today, and I've got one or two parcels left. You can buy one of those. And I remember there was a bar of chocolate and 10 cigarettes and some sandwiches. And so I got them and said, thanks very much. And went up home. I saved the chocolate for my mother. I smoked in those days. And then I said to my mother, you know, there was a very nice girl, Natty Manageress. I must really go and say thank you to her because of this. I said, really nice girl. So she told me, she said, yeah, I never heard you talking about nice girls and things like that before. So I went round, and of course that was Vi, my wife. That was how I met her. And she also, she was machine gun, she was bombed and so on. And actually once she was on her bunk in the rest period, and Jerry came across machine gun in the camp, she heard him coming, so she rolled off her bunk onto the floor, and machine gun fire came through the roof and filled her mattress full of ammunition. She dug them all. I said, someday I'll make those into a necklace. She said, well, I'm not going to wear it. But she's got them in the house somewhere. She's got all the bullets she dug out of her mattress and so on. And she was, she really got
there. Did you feel that as an officer that would come up through the ranks, that that in any way was an advantage for you personally with regard to working with other rankers and men?
No. If anything, they were a bit wary of you. Because they thought most officers were bloody fools, but if you'd been in the ranks, you must know something. But that was in the days when there were, you know, before the war, the officers were a separate race. No, I don't think so. They were lads I knew, you know. And
how long were you with the 14th Battalion?
Well, I was with them until I was with them for the thick end of a year, you know, because I didn't go abroad. I didn't leave them until October 42. And I was with them from 1941 until...
And had your role changed in that year at all?
No, I was still more... no, our role, we were still along that part of the front. We never moved. We moved along in some of the big hotels in Folkestone, up the hill in Shorncliffe Camp, and along in Hyde and places like that. But and we did a few exercises behind and to the flank and so on. But we never... we were there as a sort of a... Coastal Defence Battalion, you know. And we were always well up to the mark and well trained and so on.
Were you losing men regularly on draft and getting new
ones in? No, not particularly, because they were drafting from Bransford, you see. But I remember Colonel Hasted, the gentleman who'd given me my 14 days up and down, he brought the band down for us and it played and we marched behind the band for a while. And then the mess, he said, to introduce us. I said, I don't quite think you require me to introduce us. I said, you already know me. You gave me 14 days over at Bransford. Did I, old boy? He said, did you deserve it? I said, oh, yes. He said, well, I don't. No hard feelings. I said, no, sir, not at all. But there wasn't much change, really. There were one or two officers who went away, but they were mostly on courses and that sort of thing, you know.
I mean, Was there any... desire to, or feeling of wanting to get out abroad and do some fighting?
Well, no, I think there was this sort of knowledge that the army hadn't trained you as an infantry officer for you to stay in England all your life, you know. And so we knew something was going to happen sometime, but we weren't quite sure how. And I was a dedicated sort of Durham Light infantryman, you see. But there were still, we used to hear words about the 2nd Battalion, which was out in India somewhere, and in general, we sort of, I think we realised that we were destined.
In your training at this stage, do you feel that the training was improving from what it had been early in the war?
I'm quite sure, it was more realistic. And especially down there, because we were daily reminded that there was a bloke over the water who didn't like us, you know, and... oh, yes, I think it was quite... the other thing I noticed, though, there were... Even at that time, I don't think any of the officers had, were in Dunkirk. I think I was the only one at that particular time. No? The other thing I remember, we got a young subaltern there once called Muir. It was Mr. Muir, who used to be in our... the Western Front Association, his son, who got two MCs with the 9th Battalion in Sicily. He was a good soldier. And But I don't think it was a lot of new troops. You know, I suppose the average age must have been quite small, because at that time, 1941, I was 28, and a lot of these were soldiers who just pulled up. You know.
Were you working more with other arms of the service, tanks, RAF?
No. We did no training with tanks, and we had Hawkins Airfield was just up the road from us. We had a defensive duty there, an event of invasion. But apart from that, we just plodded around and got fit and fired our rifles and so on. There were the Hythe Rangers down there, you see, and that sort of thing. And I went on one or two courses, battle course and that sort of thing, you know, battle training, where they used to really put you through it, you know.
In what ways did they put you through it?
Well, you were fired up with live ammunition. You had to creep under, you'd find a lot of trace, and you had to creep forward and creep under the trace, or otherwise you'd get hit. And they were allowed at that time quite a high percentage of casualties, you know. So they really taught you to keep your head down and not to be silly and that sort of thing. And also, great expenditure of energy to really keep you fit. I suppose we must have been extremely fit. And as I say, these practically daily visits by the Hun from over the water means that we were quite understood that we were going to get a nasty reception party if they had the nerve to come across, you know. And sometimes, away out to sea, we'd hear these torpedo boats and E-boats firing and racing up and down, you know, right out. Because it's only 21 miles across from there, you know, across the other side. But
were the sea defences that you were manning, coastal defences?
There's just slip trenches, which we made, slip trenches and which we maintained. And in some of the buildings we had sandbagged, you know, some of the hotels and so on. There was one place called St. Andrew's Home, which had been some sort of religious home up on the ground. Each room had a virtue, each sort of cell had a virtue over it. I remember they took great pride, you know, they'd put the officers in the room, sort of chastity and forbearance and so on. We'd sleep in separate rooms like that, because it'd been a real religious home. And we had that slit trenches dug out round there and wire and that sort of thing, you know, because it was just over the harbour. But, that was the harbour where I'd come across from Dunkirk, you know. My first visit to folks had been from Dunkirk, you know. But I think we were just being kept fit and learning how to handle our weapons and so on, and how to carry our equipment and so on, and generally being. And every now and then have exercises like bayonet. The old-fashioned bayonet was still considered to be quite a, we should be proficient in that. Whether the powers that be thought it would be, if we were engaged, or it would be bayoneting Germans on the Folkestone beaches, I don't understand, but that was the setup.
Were you well equipped?
We had plenty of ammunition we had the 3-inch mortars. Mind you, I had, except once or twice when I fired on the range, I had all my mortars, and I had them polished. Fuse pieces and so on were polished and cleaned and so on. They would have dazzled the enemy if I hadn't killed them, you know. We kept everything absolutely sparkling in our carrying first class order. And motorcycle. We used motorcycles for liaison. We used to go out round the country. There wasn't a place, a little niche which had been used by smugglers that I didn't know about out in my motorbike. And every time I looked, I knew places which hadn't been used since the old smugglers were there, where I knew I could put a mortar and make it useful, you know.
Did you get involved with training the Home Guard?
Not at all. No, we had nothing at all there. In fact, the Home Guard might well not have existed. Now, that might well have been because the Home Guard in that area would be the Buffs, East Kents, so they might not have been appropriate for us Durhamite infantry to be training them. Probably they were trained by instructors from the Buffs and so on. And then inland towards Maidstone, well, that was the Royal West Kent, with which I subsequently became embroiled. And they would probably be trained by instructors from their regiments.
Had the villages and hamlets and towns which were actually on the coast and which you were defending, had they been... Had the population been sent away? Were they empty?
They weren't empty, by any means. But a large number had gone. But of course, for all the old diehards, I said, he didn't shift me in the last war, he's not bloody well shifted me in this war, you know. And that was the general sort of way. There were quite a few people around, but there were a lot had been sent, a lot of children had been sent away in England, you know. But you see, there were the girls working in the Naffy, and they were doing... And one or two hotels were operating in Folkestone, not very many. The rest were being taken over. Shops were there and so on, and there were still civilians.
Were you popular with the inhabitants?
I think we were, because we were very well disciplined. But there wasn't an awful lot of communication, because in those far-off days, nowadays with the sort of radio and television and so on, we know that Yorkshire people come from Yorkshire and Geordies come... But there wasn't much liaison between Geordies and South Country people, you know, at that time. You know, they both professed not to understand each other and that sort of thing. You know, there was a little bit of local sort of feeling, but there was no antagonism.